All right, good morning, everybody. Bio 241, and it is Tuesday, September 20th. We're going to finish up chapter 4, move into chapter 5 today. Just a few things in chapter 4 we got to touch on. But I do want to bring your attention to the schedule, in particular the lab schedule. Your lab schedule calls for quiz number 5 this week, along with an action potential quiz. That's an extra credit quiz, action potential. That's what that AP stands for. But I've postponed that quiz 1 week. Action potential will be given next week. And replacing that one is going to be a respiration, cellular respiration drawing. All right, so you're going to get 2 extra credit quizzes, action potential next week. But I do want to point out, besides the change in the schedule, those of you that have lab on Thursday, if you don't do that quiz until Thursday, it might be a little late to help you in lecture. All right, so try to look at that action potential before the end of next week is what I'm trying to say. Okay. So it's good that you guys are doing respiration this week, because that's what we're going to start talking about today. But try to get to that action potential, at least studying at home, before the end of next week, because it might be a little bit late to help you. So these extra credit quizzes are actually designed to help you understand things that we're talking about in lecture. And of course, lab is supposed to reinforce lecture. So don't wait until the end of next week to do that, because I think you'll miss the magic. You'll get the extra credit point, but it won't help you as much in lecture as it possibly could. Any questions on that? It's just a drawing, yeah. And they're always a little bit modified compared to what's in your textbook. So, and I sent an email out to everybody, so really look at the email. And you can use your textbook as a key as to how to draw it, but look at your email. And to print them out, and maybe I forgot to mention this in the email, and that is to print it out really nice. What I send you is a JPEG, but maybe what you want to do is copy that JPEG, paste it into a Microsoft Word document or a PowerPoint document, and then you can scale it, position it however you want. And maybe I'll send them to you not as a JPEG, but as a PDF file, and then you don't have to do that extra step. Something like that. We'll work on that. If that's a huge problem for somebody, let me know. Okay, I can change the formatting. Yeah. Yeah. There's one for this week, and it's the cellular respiration, and the one for next week is action potential. Even though I have action potential this week in the lab schedule, all right. So I've added one, and so I'm going to postpone action potential until next week. Yeah. Okay. Okay. But the sooner you start looking at that action potential, the better off you'll be in lecture. Okay. All right. So that's just a little bit of bookkeeping. So let's move on to where we left off last time. We're talking about thermodynamics, which has to deal with energy. And energy is kind of an abstract term. It's not something that we can measure easily with a scale. We can measure it, because we can measure heat coming off of different kinds of chemical reactions using a thermometer. So indirectly, we can measure energy, and by looking at the difference in the temperature of different systems, we can come up with a measurement of energy, which is given in kcals. Right? Calories is a measure of energy. Right? So, and remember, energy gives the system the ability to do work. That's the best way to think of energy. All right, let me get the slideshow started right here. And there's something that's pretty ironic. I really like irony a lot. There's a little bottle in the grocery store that you can buy that's a 5-hour energy drink, right? Okay, and you can, and they're really popular. Okay, I don't go through too many in one day. And if you look at the ingredients on the bottle, a lot of the ingredients in a bottle will always tell you how many calories are in that bottle. And what's really nice, you can buy this 5-hour energy drink with 0 calories in it, which means what? It has no energy. So it's really a brainstorm of some marketing department to come up with that, because in order to have energy, it's got to have what? Carbohydrates or lipids or proteins in there. And probably the only thing it really has is caffeine. which works on your central nervous system, in particular the reticular activating system, to just keep you awake, keep you from falling asleep, or it will wake you up if you are asleep. And so, anyway, that's kind of funny. So remember that when we're talking about energy, it's calories or kilocalories, which is thousands of calories. And that kind of, that little bottle right there always brings a smile to my face, right? Because it has nothing to do with energy whatsoever, but it makes you feel like you have energy, okay? And I'm sure we all have plenty of energy in our bodies to work. All right, so the first law of thermodynamics, so I lost my cursor. First law of thermodynamics was what? Energy can't be created or destroyed, right? It can just be interchanged from one state to another, and we talked about different states of energy, like light is energy. That's an electromagnetic form of energy. There's chemical energy. What's your favorite form of chemical energy? You might want to say like maltose. ATP is really good. I was thinking more on lines of milkshake, but ATP is really good. Or maybe gasoline is a chemical form of energy. And you can convert these things. Your body converts carbohydrates into ATP, and then ATP is the universal energy carrier inside your body for muscle contraction or running various kinds of pumps in your body for conscious thought or transmitting electrical information through nerves. Oh, thanks for the sign-in sheet. All right, so that's the first law of thermodynamics. Not too difficult to understand that one. Second law of thermodynamics, a little bit more abstract, states that energy transformations increase entropy. Well, what the heck is entropy? Well, it's a degree of disorganization in the system. And if we look at a human being, we see that we're highly organized. Even when we started looking at a cell, what does a cell have that's highly organized? At least human cells, eukaryotic cells, have organelles, right, that are special structures, special highly organized units inside of a cell that have highly specialized functions. And they're in there so that all these functions don't interfere with each other. All right, well, how is it that the human body is highly organized, but the only way anything can proceed in our universe if it becomes disorganized? So you have to enlarge your thinking a little bit. Not only should you think of your biological system as being highly organized, but also the things that we excrete. And one of the things that we excrete from our bodies is temperature. All right, and what is the temperature of, say, a solution? Give me a molecular understanding of what temperature is. What is temperature? It really means motion, okay? Motion of molecules. And as the temperature increases, what happens to the motion of molecules? Do they slow down or speed up? They speed up, right? So the biochemistry inside us, we can organize molecules and become highly organized, but whenever we do that, what happens to not just our bodies, but everything else in the universe? It becomes more randomized because one of the things that our body exports is heat and temperature, and when we export temperature, that increases the randomness around us. Right? So the universe actually gets warmer when we organize our internal structure. All right, so we don't disobey the second law of thermodynamics. Right? Our bodies become more organized, but that means that our surroundings become more disorganized as a result of that, right? Because we export heat into the environment, right? When we become organized. So only free energy, that is energy in an organized state, can be used to do work. And one of the molecules that we use that's highly organized, right, to perform work is glucose, right? So it's a bunch of carbon dioxide molecules that have been put together into a long hydrocarbon chain. Then it's highly organized, and it can then release energy. Our bodies use that molecule, break it down into carbon dioxide and water, and then we can organize our internal structure. All right, so systems have a tendency to go from states of high free energy to states of low free energy. And when you think of a system here, you have to think not only your body, but your immediate environment as well. Okay, so just our presence increases the temperature of our environment, which increases the randomness, which then makes these thermodynamic processes possible. And as a matter of fact, maybe we could use an analogy of an automobile. You put chemical energy in, and you get some mechanical energy out, all right? And that's that's doing a lot of work in a highly organized way, but why is that allowed by the second law of thermodynamics? Why does thermodynamics, the second law, allow an automobile to work? All right, it's very organized work, bringing you from your house to school and then to work. Right, but why is that possible? Because the amount of energy that's in the gasoline, most of it ends up as just creating random motion in our world, right? Because how much heat does your car produce? If you were to touch the exhaust pipe on your car, right, it would burn you almost immediately. And I forget what the figure is, but basically when you go buy gasoline at the pump, 80% of what you're paying for is just producing heat, which is not work, right? So only about 20% of that energy is used to move you from one place to another. It's highly inefficient, right, which is kind of astounding. All right, so the second law dictates that living organisms require a continual input of energy in order to stay organized. All right, so here is a nice plot of free energy. As we kind of move up the scale, we get more and more free energy. So for biological systems, where, at least our current understanding of biology, where does most of this energy come from? Right, it comes from the sun in terms of light energy, and fortunately there are certain organisms on our planet that can trap that energy, and they can then take up carbon dioxide and water, right, and while they're trapping that energy, and they can combine carbon dioxide and water to make glucose. And so they're, what do we call a molecule that can trap light energy, that can absorb light energy? Okay, that's a process, but what kind of molecule? In anatomy, we talked about a specific kind of molecule. I'm not sure we have yet in this class, but it's called a pigment. Okay, so a pigment is just some kind of chemical that can absorb some energy from light. And remember, light has different kinds of wavelengths, and every wavelength corresponds to a different amount of energy. So certain pigments can absorb certain energy levels, while other pigments absorb other colors. So a color and an energy level is really the same kind of thing. What kind of color does a plant not absorb? What kind of color light does a plant reflect? Green. Yeah, so plants don't absorb that energy level, but they can absorb what, like blue and red and things like that, at least a typical kind of plant that we're familiar with. All right, so it takes those red wavelengths and blue wavelengths, and it uses that energy to synthesize glucose from carbon dioxide. So it's really a shame that we don't have these pigments, that we're not kind of colored green, because we could go sit on the beach and like make milkshakes all day long inside our bodies. But we can't do that. We got to rely on plants to do that. Okay, so a plant can become highly organized, right? Because sugar right here is much more organized than carbon dioxide, and the plant uses a lot more energy, right, to make a glucose molecule than just the free energy in glucose. And then it releases the rest of that energy into the environment, increasing the entropy in the environment around us. All right, so then where do we get our energy from? We consume plant products, right, or byproducts, namely this glucose. And then the free energy of glucose is pretty high, not as high as the sun, of course. And then our bodies use the free energy that has been trapped in glucose by plants to run ourselves. All right, so here's more of a picture of us, and plants kind of use this too. Like for instance, at night, they require energy. So what's a good energy molecule floating around that we get from plants? It is glucose right here, and we can see that it's really high on the free energy scale. All right, and as a matter of fact, that glucose can be used in plants to make wood. So cellulose is basically just made out of glucose. It's just put together in a little bit different way. So remember, with just a dehydration synthesis reaction, we can take monomers, and let's just pretend my hands are glucose molecules, although the handedness is not really the same because I got my right hand is different than my left hand, but let's pretend they're the same. When we put glucose molecules together in our body, it's like this. Okay, when a plant puts glucose molecules together, all right, it's like that. So there's a little bit conformation change. So the structure is different. So guess what? That molecule behaves differently. Cellulose behaves differently because it's put together in a little bit different way. So if we take cellulose and put it in a glass of water, will it dissolve? Okay, basically wood. If you take a toothpick and you put it, toothpick is just cellulose, so we put it in a glass of water, will it dissolve? Nah, because the chemical bond is a little bit different, which is really handy for plants because if cellulose dissolved in water, what would happen to a tree every time it rained? It would melt away, right? So that glucose, the same thing that we have in this nice handrail in the room over here, right, wood, is just put together in a little bit different way so it doesn't dissolve, but it still has that free energy associated with it. It's still packed with energy, and there are certain animals that can actually chew on wood and get the energy out. Does anybody have any animals in mind that can actually chew on wood? And for them, it's like eating a sugar cube to us. What kind of animal is that? It's a real pest, because most of our houses are made out of wood. But these little insects go in there and start chewing it up. It's termites, right? They can actually, so they think wood in your house is like a milkshake. And indeed for them it is. Because the basic building block is what? Glucose right here. Okay, so some animals can do that. But this is what we do in our bodies. We consume glucose in our food. We need some oxygen. And we can then convert glucose all the way back down to carbon dioxide and water. And when that happens, the free energy of carbon dioxide in water is a lot less than the free energy in glucose. And guess what our body can then do? It can then siphon off this energy through this and this is a metabolic pathway for our own biological purposes. Right? There is a way to convert glucose or cellulose into carbon dioxide in water in just one step. What do we call that? That's combustion. Like if we were to overcome the activation energy barrier in wood that's in this room by heating it up with a match or something, you can get it to burn. But in every case, since these reactants right here have a higher free energy compared to the products, all right, we call that what? An exergonic reaction. That's an exergonic reaction. If the products have more free energy than the reactants, that would be an endergonic reaction. They would require energy from someplace. All right, so this is kind of a nice overview of what's happening inside our body. There are many reactions in our body that are endergonic, that require energy. Okay, where do they get that energy from? This burning of the respiration, cellular respiration of glucose in our bodies releases energy so that some endergonic reactions can take place. All right, so our body does get energy from converting glucose into carbon dioxide and water. So that's certainly an allowed process, as long as we can get energy someplace. All right, so when glucose is broken down, on this previous slide, when glucose is broken down to CO2 and water, okay, what is another physical entity that is produced? And I see it on this slide right here. All right, so we could have a chemical reaction, CO2 plus oxygen with an arrow going to CO2 and water. But what else should we put in that chemical reaction to make it sense? Okay, heat, or, yeah, I like heat, but let's just call that energy. Okay, so where would you put energy? With the reactants over here or the products? Yeah, with the products, because this is a nice exergonic reaction. All right, so let's move on to this slide over here. So again, we have a plot of free energy. We have reactants going to products. All right, and just on like on that previous slide, there's a lot of energy that's being released when this blue wheel turns. Is that a nice blue wheel right here? Kind of looks like a gear. Okay, so a lot of energy is released. And it's coupled, because of the biochemistry inside our bodies, all right, to this reaction right here, reactants going to products. Now, in this smaller wheel, which is, I don't know, kind of looks gray to me. Oh, but there's an inside color too right there, but I don't know. Is that just gray, or maybe it's a pink color? I don't know. Who knows? Okay, a little washed out green. Okay, now here we have reactants at what kind of level of free energy compared to products? Reactants at a relatively low free energy, but the products are at a higher free energy. So what kind of reaction is that? When reactants have lower compared to products that are high, that is what? Endergonic reaction. These are unfavorable reactions, but if they're coupled to reactions that are highly exergonic, then this wheel can turn and your body can form these products right here. As long as what? These chemical reactions are coupled to each other, as demonstrated by having these gears. So endergonic reactions are definitely possible in your body, but what do they need? They need some metabolic pathway that is highly exergonic to do that. And what about if the wheels were exactly the same size? Then it would not be a very favorable reaction. And the difference in the wheel just shows, like, from this level here to this level here, this you could think of as almost like wasted energy inside our bodies, but then this is the part of the energy equation that satisfies the second law of thermodynamics, right? So this energy right here is just released into our environment, and it increases the randomness of molecules around us that allows our structures to be built up. Okay, so we need a constant input of energy. And this is the whole topic of the next chapter. Okay, the exergonic reactions, right? So here's that exergonic reaction. When this wheel is turning, guess what molecule it's making? It's making ATP, right? So some of this energy is then trapped in ATP, and then ATP can be hydrolyzed into ADP, which will then release that energy to other unfavorable reactions inside our body. So most exergonic reactions in our body, like on the previous slide right here, glucose going to carbon dioxide, most of these exergonic reactions are used in our body to make ATP, right? And then our body can use ATP to run other endergonic reactions that require ATP, because ATP is the universal energy carrier inside our body. All right, so here's a nice picture of ATP. You don't have to memorize the structure, but ATP, you can see that it has how many phosphates on it? Yeah, it has three phosphates right here, hence you get the name adenosine triphosphate. All right, and a common way that adenosine triphosphate is made is that you have some inorganic phosphate, which is a PO4 group that I see right here, and an adenosine diphosphate. How many phosphates does adenosine diphosphate have? It just has two. It just has what we call the alpha, right, and beta phosphorus right here, and then the terminal one, sometimes we call that a gamma. Mitochondria take ADP and this inorganic phosphate, combine them together, but it needs energy from glucose to do that, and that energy goes into this little chemical bond right here. All right, so mitochondria make this thing all the time. And I think we've talked about ATP. How much ATP does your body need as a fraction of your body weight? Yeah, it's about 60%. I think we talked about that. Typical textbook weight is about 70 kilogram person, and you need about 40 kilograms of ATP broken down into ADP every day to maintain your living processes. Another way to think about ATP, if we cut off oxygen to the brain, how long can your brain survive? Because your brain needs a lot of ATP. How long can you maintain consciousness without oxygen going to your brain? Just a couple seconds, like 2 or 3 seconds. Remember us talking about that? Yeah, okay. And then after a certain period of time, when it runs out of energy completely, the brain dies and it can never be resuscitated. What's that period of time? About 2 to 3 minutes, right? So that's why this molecule is so important, because it can donate this energy in this covalent bond. And remember, covalent bonds are what? The high energy bonds, the strongest bonds to run brain functions. All right, let's talk about a class of chemical reactions that we only talked about in kind of passing before, and that is oxidation reduction reactions. And these can kind of be tricky to think about, so for sure over the weekend you want to review this concept a couple times, but always start with a basic definition of what an oxidation reduction reaction is. And here it is. If a molecule gains electrons, it becomes reduced. So even if you have to write that out 100 times, you got to do it. Maybe just writing it out 5 times will help, or maybe just reading it a couple times, you can memorize that. All right. So if a molecule gains an electron, it becomes reduced. If it loses electrons, does it become reduced? No. And opposite happens. It becomes oxidized. All right. So a molecule, when it loses electrons, when it gives electrons up, it becomes oxidized. So a reducing agent is something that can donate electrons to another molecule. An oxidizing agent is then a molecule that will accept electrons. All right, so there is kind of a corollary right here. If there is a molecule or a reducing agent that can donate electrons, it can only do so if it has a partner. What does it have to have nearby? An oxidizing agent, right, to accept those electrons. So a molecule can't donate an electron unless there's another molecule nearby that can accept those electrons. So that's why we say that this kind of reaction always happens as what? An oxidation-reduction reaction, because that electron just can't go someplace by itself. It's got to hop from one molecule to another. All right, so oxidation-reduction reactions are always coupled reactions. And in your book, sometimes they make a big deal of it involves transfer of hydrogen ions instead of electrons. I suppose that's another nice way of thinking about it, but I'm always going to think about it in terms of transferring electrons from one molecule to another. And that's how I would like for you to look at it. So an electron is going to hop from one molecule to another to another. And what's the charge of an electron? Does it have an electrical charge? Yeah, it has one negative charge on it, right? So it has an electrical charge. And what the heck do we call an electrical charge that's in motion, going from one place to another? An electrical charge in motion is what we call a current, right? And so molecules can develop little electrical currents when electrons can hop from one molecule to another. So you can kind of forget about these hydrogens right here, right? I just want you to think in terms of electrons. All right, last time we learned about something called a cofactor and a coenzyme. And maybe you can remember what some of these definitions are, at least in the domain of this class. It might not serve you well in other branches of biochemistry and things like that, but for this class, what's a good definition of a cofactor? A cofactor. It's a metal ion. How complicated is a metal ion? It's just a small little ion in solution. And what about a coenzyme? It's a big organic molecule, right, with at least 20 different kinds of atoms joined together to form a molecule. And it could be huge, could have 100 different atoms. All right, so a coenzyme is a biological molecule. A cofactor is an inorganic metal ion. So when I say a coenzyme right here, what are you going to have pictured in your mind? Kind of a big organic molecule, which is something that you can't draw out because it's too complicated. But it's going to be a big organic molecule, big biological molecule. And what's it going to carry? Electrons. Okay? So it's going to carry electrons, and it's going to carry electrons from one biochemical pathway to another. So it's almost like a transfer RNA, I suppose. You could think of a transfer RNA as being a coenzyme. It doesn't carry electrical charges, but it carries amino acids from one place to another. All right. These coenzymes right here are actually carrying electrons from one set of reactions to another, and those electrons are at a high energy level. So NAD and FAD carry high energy electrons from one set of metabolic reactions to another. These particular compounds, these are also vitamins. That means something. What the heck is a vitamin? Can you make a vitamin in your body? No, some living organisms can, but our bodies have lost the ability to do that, so we need to consume those products in our diet. So a vitamin is an essential nutrient. It allows metabolic pathways to work properly in our body, but our bodies can't make vitamins. We have to have them in our diet. And two examples of this would be NAD and FAD right here. What do these things look like? Aha. Here we see some examples of NAD on the top, FAD on the bottom. It's a little bit small maybe for the projection right here, depending. Maybe the screen on the right shows it a little bit better. But here I see an adenine molecule. I see a ribose. I see a phosphorus. What does that kind of remind you of? Like the adenine nucleotide, right? That even is made up of ATP. So these are cousin molecules to ATP and cousin molecules that are used to make nucleic acids like DNA and RNA. Just a little bit of a complicated feature right here. All right, so on this ring structure, it is possible that it can bind a couple hydrogens, and when it does, all right, it's going to accept a couple of electrons, and I can see a couple of electrons right here on this nitrogen group. All right, so NAD is going to go from NAD plus. All right, so this overall structure has a plus charge, but when it accepts two electrons, it wipes out that plus charge right here, and a hydrogen is going to bind to it. just in this location right over here. So NAD plus gets converted to NADH. Right? So NAD is in an oxidized state. If we add an electron to it, when we add an electron to something, what happens to it? Does it become oxidized or reduced? It becomes reduced. So NADH is a reduced form because it's carrying these two electrons right here. And these are high energy electrons that can be transferred to another molecule. And does this look like a small metal ion? No. It's a big, complicated organic molecule. So this right here, NAD plus or NADH, is what? A cofactor or a coenzyme? It's a coenzyme, right? And so the job of a coenzyme is to transfer something from one reaction to another. And what is NADH transferring from one reaction to another? These high energy electrons right here. That's what I want you to see. Okay, a similar kind of compound is FAD. And again, I can see a nice ribose sugar and an adenine base, phosphate, but it gets really complicated up in this region right here. It looks a little bit different than NAD, but still, is this a cofactor or a coenzyme? It's a coenzyme because it's a big organic molecule. And again, there are a couple sites right here that can accept two electrons and two hydrogens, right? And so it doesn't change its ionic state, but don't forget, there are two high-energy electrons that are trapped in this structure that FADH2 can donate to another set of chemical reactions someplace. So FAD is the oxidized state. When it accepts electrons, it becomes reduced, all right? And when FAD is converted into FADH2, meaning what FAD is what? Reduced to FADH2, what has to happen to another molecule? Because these are always coupled reactions. That other molecule has to become oxidized when that happens. Okay. The same thing for NADH. When NAD gets converted to NADH, another molecule has to become oxidized because that's the nature of an oxidation reduction reaction. All right, so that's the difference between cofactors and coenzymes, and I think we're done with this particular chapter right here. Okay, so FAD, NAD are just what? Cousin molecules of ATP. Okay. So that's this chapter. Let's see if I can find the X button. All right, so that was 4, so we're going to move on to 5. All right, so how does let me get the pointer options working right here. Okay, cellular respiration. Let's start with some basic definitions first. Metabolism. Metabolism is a word that describes all the chemical reactions that are taking place in your body. That's metabolism. Okay, and metabolism can be broken down into two kinds of chemical reactions. Reactions that break molecules down and reactions that do what? The opposite of that, build molecules together. Okay, so those have specific names. Catabolism is the subset of metabolism that can break molecules down. And a good example of that would be, for instance, maybe a protein. Protein has building blocks, amino acids that can be broken down, right, into amino acids. That's an example of catabolism. That releases energy. Right, so catabolism always releases energy. Another molecule, glycogen in our body. What's the building block of glycogen in our body? Glucose, right? And glycogen can be broken down, and that's what we call catabolism. And then what about that particular process? Does that require energy or release energy when you break glycogen down into glucose? It releases energy. So is that exergonic or endergonic? That is exergonic. Yeah, it's a nice exergonic reaction. And then that energy can actually be used, right, for making ATP. Okay, so catabolism in our body generally is used to make ATP. Anabolism, on the other hand, is when you have building blocks that come together to make a large molecule. Okay, and those are endergonic reactions. It requires energy. Like when we take fatty acids and glycerol and make what out of that? Triglyceride, that's anabolism. Or when we take amino acids and make a big protein out of it, that's anabolism. Or when we take glucose molecules and put them together to make glycogen, that's anabolism as well. All right, that's going to require energy. Okay, so where does that energy come from for anabolism inside our body? It's the most direct molecule that makes that possible is ATP. Okay, ATP. Okay. All right, so that's metabolism. So here's another way of looking at metabolism. We get to, and this is your drawing, extra credit drawing, part of it anyway, in lab today. All right, this is a kind of an overview. So for the next couple of lectures, I think you probably want to have this in your mind or on a piece of paper right next to you to see where all these different processes are taking place. And what do we have right here? Well, we've got some organ systems. We've got the digestive system, and there's a little accessory structure of the digestive system, which is the liver. So I see the digestive system and liver. And then I've got a blood vessel right here, nicely color-coded red. And then there's a little bit of an interstitial space between them outside the cells, and then here is the area that's inside of a cell. So this is just an intracellular space of any kind of typical cell. Like, for instance, a good one maybe would be like a muscle cell. Say this is a muscle cell. And then that muscle cell has got a couple different spaces. Here is the cytoplasm, and then this color down here represents things that are happening inside a mitochondria. Right, so that's a special little compartment within the cell. All right, so here we have glucose in the blood. Where can glucose come from if it's in the blood? Two sources. If it can come from your digestive tract, if you're in the fed state. If you've just eaten something, then you have complex sugars in your digestive tract, and it's breaking them down into simple sugars like glucose, and then your small intestine absorbs glucose, right? And now we have high concentrations of glucose in the blood. But you're not always in a fed state. When are you not in a fed state? Like maybe if you don't work all night long, right? If you're asleep all night long, maybe 4 o'clock in the morning, you're in what kind of state? Not a fed state, but a fasted state. So if you're in a fasted state, your blood glucose is going to have a tendency to drop. But it can't drop too far because your body needs glucose to stay alive. Okay, here is an organ that maintains blood glucose, and that is the liver. The liver is loaded with glycogen, and what's the building block of glycogen? It's glucose. So the liver is told to break glycogen down into glucose, and then it's going to release glucose, and it's going to end up in the blood, maintaining blood glucose concentration. Yeah. So over here, you've got the fed state. Over here, you got the fasted state. Oh, it's the other way. Glycogen, the building block of glycogen is glucose. So when you break glycogen down, you get glucose. In order to build glycogen, you need glucose to make it. Okay. Yeah, good question. We'll see how that happens in some detail. All right, so you got glucose in the blood, and then glucose enters this cell just by a concentration gradient. We're going to see how that happens. It's under endocrine control. There's got to be special transporters in the cell membrane of this cell right here, because glucose can't get across the cell membrane by itself because glucose is polar. The cell membrane, remember, is hydrophobic. But if the glucose gets inside the cell, then it can be used to make some ATP. The first process of breaking down glucose is what we call glycolysis. What can you tell me about this word right here, lysis? It means snipping apart, means breaking down. All right, and glyco means glucose, so it's the breaking down of glucose. All right, so what kind of reaction is this, breaking glucose down? Is that catabolism or anabolism? It's catabolism. And is that exergonic or endergonic? It's exergonic. It releases energy. So glycolysis is the first exergonic metabolic pathway that we're looking at that's going to release energy. All right. When you look at this slide right here, it's not on the slide, but it is on the one that you have to draw in lab. What's the purpose of all of this stuff right here? It's not on this slide, but I do want you to know. I don't want to tell you, maybe for a couple of days. Okay. So this is cellular respiration. What is the whole point of cellular respiration? It's not on this slide. And maybe don't tell anybody if you see what it is. Maybe at the end of lecture you could tell everybody. Okay, but I want to think about some of the details before getting the big picture. All right, but it's on the previous slide in the last chapter. All right, so how many carbon atoms does glucose have? Does anybody remember? It's got six, right? This process right here, glycolysis, it has many steps in it, but basically it snips glucose in half. So you have two three-carbon molecules. Those three-carbon molecules we call pyruvic acid, or you could call it pyruvate. Pyruvate and pyruvic acid are exactly the same thing, and I'll use those terms interchangeably, so don't get lost with that. Okay, so that's an exergonic reaction, meaning what? It releases energy. Now here, pyruvic acid, how many faiths does pyruvic acid have? Well, you can see that by looking at the arrows on this diagram. It has two faiths. It can enter the mitochondria, or it can be converted into lactic acid. And what's going to determine that is the state of oxygen inside the cell. So under anaerobic conditions, which means what in terms of oxygen? No oxygen or very low oxygen concentration, pyruvic acid gets converted to lactic acid. But if oxygen is present, right, it can enter the mitochondria, and aerobic processes can further degrade these three carbon molecules into what? Just a single carbon molecule called CO2. And when you have a three-carbon molecule being broken down into three one-carbon molecules, what is that? Is that anabolism or catabolism? That is still breaking molecules down again. That's highly exergonic, right? And what do we call that when we break molecules down? That is? Oh, I hear both. Anabolism or catabolism? All right, catabolism breaks down, releases energy, okay? And in the previous chapter, what does your body do with reactions that release energy? It likes to take that energy and trap it in ATP, in the form of ATP. Okay, so inside the mitochondria, we've got a couple important reactions. I've got an arrow here that's not labeled. We're going to label that arrow pretty soon. It's not labeled on your extra credit quiz, but we got the Krebs cycle, and you can see it kind of goes around and around and around in the cycle. And then we've got electron transport, right? And this is all part of the aerobic respiration. So on this slide, I could ask you, where does anaerobic respiration take place inside the cell? Anaerobic respiration, where does it take place? Ah, cytoplasm. Where does aerobic respiration take place? In the mitochondria. So that means in order for mitochondria to do its job, what does it need besides some product of glycolysis? There's another molecule a mitochondria needs in order to do its job. Okay? It needs, because it's aerobic respiration, it needs oxygen. And you don't see it on this slide right here, so you could probably put what? Oxygen plus these things, right, produces CO2. So this slide is deficient in some things, but it's a good place to start. Okay. Now, what kind of tissue might operate under anaerobic conditions, under conditions where there's no oxygen? Like muscle, for instance, because when a muscle is doing its job, when it contracts, what does it turn into? This incredible mass of what? Just solid material. It's so solid that blood can't get into it, right? And since blood can't get into it, blood isn't delivering oxygen, so it becomes anaerobic. So any kind of heavy exercise of a muscle is going to produce anaerobic conditions. Okay, so just kind of keep this whole scheme in mind. I'm going to refer to this slide over and over and over again. All right, so the first process, glycolysis right here. Where does that take place? Cytoplasm. What is the beginning molecule for glycolysis? Glucose. And what's the end molecule? Is pyruvate. Pyruvate, you're really close. Okay, I don't want you to forget about that one. As a matter of fact, that might be the most important one, but I don't want to tell everybody yet. So glycolysis is converting glucose into two pyruvate molecules. Okay. Does it require oxygen? No. Okay. The overall reaction for glycolysis is glucose going to two pyruvates plus a couple other things. This NAD, right? That is a cofactor or a coenzyme? Coenzyme is going to be carrying a couple high energy electrons when NAD plus gets converted to NADH, right? So NADH is the reduced form, NAD is the oxidized form. But also look what happens when glycolysis is operating. Not only does it produce these NADH right here, it produces what? It's got to be your favorite molecule, right? ATP. Two ATPs. Is that a lot of ATP for every one glucose? That's not very much, okay? But don't ever turn ATP down. It's a good molecule to have. So this is a nice exergonic reaction, and it's coupled to ATP synthesis right here. It produces a little bit of ATP. All right. So glycolysis is exergonic, right? That energy can be used to make two ATPs, but it also produces two NADHs. What did we say about NADHs? What is it carrying around from one reaction to another? It's carrying electrons, but more importantly, what kind of electrons? High energy electrons. Electrons that have a lot of energy associated with them. So not only do you get ATP, but NADHs are almost like having ATP around because they're carrying high energy electrons. All right. So glucose, it's got to be activated before glycolysis can take place. So let's take a look at this slide right here. Here we have a plot of some of the metabolic intermediates of glycolysis, and it's plotted against free energy versus the course of glycolysis as it takes place. So glucose enters the cell, it's in the cytoplasm. It has a certain free energy, right? And glucose is a polar molecule, but sometimes it can actually leave the cell, right? And the way that the cell traps glucose inside of it, because you don't want it running out, right, is to phosphorylate it. So an ATP is used to phosphorylate glucose. And what kind of molecule is ATP, a high energy or low energy molecule? It's high energy. It then delivers that energy to glucose, so it becomes glucose phosphate, glucose 1 phosphate. And that phosphate group is a highly polar compound. It has a lot of electrical charges on it. So glucose now becomes even more polar, which means what? It has even more difficulty leaving the cell, getting through the cell membrane. So as soon as it becomes phosphorylated, it becomes higher in energy, but it can't ever leave the cell. And most cells are really greedy with glucose. They don't want to give it up. All right. Now, before glycolysis can really take place, it requires another phosphorylation. And so another ATP molecule is used up to make glucose 1,6. So there's two phosphates on glucose. So now glucose has a lot of free energy on it. And then glucose starts a bunch of rearrangements, and it's cut in half. And in so doing, right, there are two steps that produce two ATPs. All right, so that's some nice energy that's being recouped. And these two NADHs right here. All right, so that, and it finally produces pyruvic acid. How many carbons are in pyruvic acid? Three, right? So glucose is chopped in half. All right, so if we look at the overall balance of this reaction right here, glycolysis requires two ATP, but four are produced. So what is the overall production or loss of ATP by glycolysis? It produces two, right? Because it takes two to get glycolysis working. But let's not forget about these NADH right here, because what's being carried right here? Some high energy electrons. And maybe that would be nice if that was a nice red oval right there. It kind of looks red to me. Is it red? Okay, signifying that those electrons can be used to do work later on. All right, so let's not forget about these NADHs. So here is a nice picture of glycolysis overall that shows the different intermediates. Okay, so we have glucose being converted into fructose, right? And there's two phosphates associated with it, and then the fructose is split into two phosphoglyceraldehydes. And do I have this as an exam figure for this semester? I forgot. Is that in your exam figure, your study guide? Do you have to be able to reproduce this thing right here? Maybe I took it out for this semester, but. Now, if you guys object to that, I can put it back in. Okay? It's okay? Well, what do I really want you to know about glycolysis? Where it takes place? Where does it take place? Cytoplasm. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, you might want to say cytosol to be really particular. Doesn't it require any organelles? The input molecule is glucose. The output is pyruvic acid. And in so doing, what is produced? 2 ATP for your living processes, and how many NADHs? 1 and 2 for every glucose molecule. For every glucose, you got 2 NADHs, and two ATPs. Because these ATPs over here, doesn't matter what side they come from, but these two ATPs over here do what? They start glycolysis, so you have to subtract those away from the net reaction. All right, so two pyruvates and two ATPs and two NADHs. That's what I want you to know, and where it takes place. Okay. Let's talk about the lactic acid pathway. After pyruvic acid is made, remember, there are two fates for pyruvic acid. Whether the cell has oxygen or maybe the cell doesn't have oxygen. So far, this is a nice metabolic pathway because it has produced some ATP for you. All right, and let's just consider under anaerobic conditions. Under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid cannot enter the mitochondria. So if I flip back to this slide, yeah. Here's pyruvic acid under anaerobic conditions. It just can't even enter the mitochondria. All right, so pyruvic acid is going to build up inside the cytoplasm. And when pyruvic acid builds up inside the cytoplasm, what happens to glycolysis? Because of the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle. Let's look at, this diagram is actually useful for one other thing. All right. How many arrows do you see from fructose 6-phosphate to fructose 1,6-biphosphate? You see two. So this reaction can go both ways. All right. So when pyruvic acid builds up inside the cell, what does it have a tendency to do because of the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle? It has a tendency to shut down, right, glycolysis. Actually, it has a tendency to make it work backwards. All right, but how is ATP made? When glycolysis is working in the forward direction or reverse direction? Only the forward direction. And what does your body need? ATP. So this reaction should be maintained going in the forward direction when you need ATP to keep you alive. All right? And so the buildup of ATP is really toxic to glycolysis. So what does your body do? It gets rid of pyruvic acid by this reaction right here. So here we have pyruvic acid, okay, being converted into lactic acid under what kind of conditions? Anaerobic conditions. But in order to do that, right, we've got to take a reduced form of NAD, which is NADH, and convert it to NAD, and that's going to allow pyruvic acid to be converted into lactic acid. And the enzyme there is called lactate dehydrogenase. Sometimes we call this anaerobic respiration or fermentation. So why else is this nice? Let's go back and look right here. When glycolysis is working in the forward direction, it's making ATP, which is perfect. We want ATP. Right? It's also making NADH. But if NADH were to build up inside the cytoplasm, what would happen to glycolysis? It would slow down and stop, number one, by Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. But also, in order for glycolysis to operate in the forward direction, what do you need? You need NAD, not NADH. Right, so if you have NADH but not NAD, glycolysis can't work either, which means what? No ATP is being made. So this fermentation reaction not only gets rid of pyruvic acid, but what does it do? It regenerates NAD so that glycolysis still can run in the forward direction. And when it does, what is it making for us? When glycolysis is working in the forward direction, pyruvic acid is going away, NADH is being converted back to NAD, but what other molecule is being built up that we need? 2 seconds, your brain can operate without it being made, okay? And that is ATP. So when NADH is being recycled into NAD, pyruvic acid is going away by this anaerobic respiration, at least glycolysis can make a couple ATPs for us to keep some cells functioning. All right, so that's the beauty of the lactic acid pathway. Let me look at this slide right here. All right, so the lactic acid pathway can produce 2 ATPs for every glucose. Okay, I think I kind of talked about some of that stuff right there. Let me put this slide right here. In lab, maybe you're doing this experiment. You're going to be doing a different kind of fermentation reaction. So when you see fermentation, it could mean with oxygen or without oxygen. And where is this lactic acid pathway? Is it with oxygen or without oxygen? That's why this slide is so important. Lactic acid pathway is what? Anaerobic, yeah, so it's without. There are some organisms that do it a little bit differently. Let's see if I have a marker right here. There's a couple of markers. Let's see if they work. Okay, so we got pyruvic acid. Oh, that's nice. How many carbon atoms does pyruvic acid have? It's got three. Okay, glycolysis is going to produce this molecule right here, plus what, some NADHs, and what, some ATPs. The ATPs don't build up inside the cell because it uses it very rapidly, but NADHs right now without oxygen, okay, don't get used up, so it builds up. What's it got, what is the buildup of NADH, what's the effect of NADH buildup on this step right here? This is what, glycolysis? It's going to stop glycolysis, going to stop the production of ATP. That's not a good thing, right? So we want to get rid of NADH, right? One reason is just to make more NAD so glycolysis can take place, but we need to get rid of that pyruvate so that it doesn't force glycolysis in the reverse direction. Some organisms do this, okay? It uses NADH, right? It produces NAD once again. But instead of a three-carbon molecule like lactic acid, you see lactic acid up there, which is a three-carbon molecule. Let's go back to here. Oh, sorry, too many. Here's lactic acid. How many carbons do you see in lactic acid? One, two, three. Okay, that's in us. What do some organisms, like yeast, what do to get rid of NADH? All right, they will make NAD. They will make CO2. So that's one carbon atom. How many carbon atoms are left? There's two. Okay, so it's this, plus another molecule right here. This is it. And there's an H here, and an H here, and then three hydrogens right here. Anybody know what this two carbon molecule is with this OH group on it? It's alcohol. This is ethyl alcohol. And what can you tell me about ethyl alcohol? Well, it's toxic. It's very toxic in our bodies, right? It's an intoxicant. It reduces the function of your central nervous system, right? But a yeast, right, can keep glycolysis working by this, what we call alcohol fermentation. So why can't a yeast get away with this? Because a little yeast cell doesn't have a brain, right? Because ethyl alcohol is not toxic to a yeast cell, but it is certainly toxic to us. So if we had alcohol fermentation in a way operating in our bodies to keep glycolysis operating, okay, under what kind of conditions? Fermentation means what? Anaerobic. Under anaerobic conditions. What would happen to us if we were to hold our breath? If we had alcohol dehydrogenase inside our bodies instead of lactate dehydrogenase. If we were to force our body to go anaerobic and we had this enzyme, what would happen to us? Well, we would get drunk just by holding our breath. Okay, that would be interesting, I suppose, but not very worthwhile, okay, because alcohol is very toxic in our bodies. All right, so sometimes in lab we use a yeast to kind of model glycolysis to understand something about the different fermentation processes. Lactic acid is not nearly so toxic in our bodies. Okay, that's under anaerobic conditions. So I got to talk about a couple other things before we get to mitochondria right here. Okay, which is the next slide. All right, so here we got four words that we got to become familiar with. And if you can't see the difference between glycogenesis glycogenolysis and glycolysis. All right, then you got to get some reading glasses because it's really important to understand sugar metabolism inside the body. Right, and we have to understand sugar metabolism before we know some pathologic conditions, for instance, like diabetes mellitus. Okay, so for osmotic reasons, cells can't store many free glucoses because what happens to the osmolality of a cell if you start to add glucose to it? The water concentration decreases, right? The solute concentration increases. That's going to draw water into the cell, and that cell might actually blow up in lice. Right, so you can't add just a lot of glucose to a cell. So what happens is the cell then will take glucoses and join them together to make glycogen. And then it's just one particle instead of thousands of solute particles in water. Okay. The process of making glycogen is called glycogenesis. Genesis is what? The production, the making of something, the making of glycogen. All right, so skeletal muscle and livers can store a lot of glucose in the form of glycogen. Another way of saying what's that glucose is the basic part of glycogen, you could think of what's the building block of glycogen, right, is glucose. And name the process that can make glycogen from glucose. That is glycogenesis right here. Okay. And that happens when you're in the fed state, which is what you can see on that first slide. Okay, when you're in a fasted state, blood glucose starts to decrease, but your body can maintain blood glucose by going and getting glycogen from the liver and chopping it up into glucose, right? And then the liver can secrete that glucose into the blood. So that process of taking glycogen and clipping off little glucose molecules from it, that's what we call glycogenolysis, right? Glycogen for glycogen, and lysis is what? The breaking down. What's the other term that's very similar to these that we've just talked about? Glycolysis. So glycolysis is kind of sounds similar to glycogenolysis, but what is glycolysis? It's the breaking down of glucose. Glycogenolysis is the breaking down of glycogen. Right? So you got to know how to spell these, and you got to be able to see them. So if those words look the same to you on a piece of paper, then you got to get those reading glasses, right? Because they're two totally different processes. They're related, but different. Yeah. No, it's a different, that's our fourth term. Yeah, we're going to go over that. Okay, so let's go back to that first slide. Here's that first slide. Oops, too far. Okay, so glucose going to pyruvate is what we call glycolysis, breaking down of glucose. Okay, glycogen going to glucose, especially in the liver, glycogen to glucose is what process? Glycogenolysis, right? And then glucose going to glycogen is what? Yeah, I know. I have to stop and think too. Is what? Glycogenesis. Okay? All right. So glycogenolysis, glycogenesis, and then there's one more. The other one that we have right here is gluconeogenesis. What does neogenesis mean? It's the making of something new. And what's being made new? Glucose. All right, so you kind of know a building block of glucose. What's a building block of glucose? It's what is the end product of glycolysis? Pyruvate. So your body can actually take two pyruvate, put them together to make new glucose out of it. All right, so that is gluconeogenesis. It's the production of glucose from non-carbohydrate molecules, maybe like lactic acid, amino acids, and maybe even pyruvic acid. And the liver does a really good job of that. Okay, a couple other terms on this slide that we see. Lipogenesis is what? The making of lipids, the formation of triglycerides. All right, what is lipolysis? The breakdown of triglycerides. All right, so genesis and lysis, you should see, are what? Antagonistic kinds of terms. So these are really important terms for you to know. Okay, glycolysis, glycogenesis, glycogenolysis, and gluconeogenesis. All right, so here's a good slide. I could probably go over this slide, but we might have to start here next time too. But let's start looking at this one, because your book does a really lousy job of describing what number 2 and number 1 are right here. Okay, so let's start. Here we got some glucose, but it's in the form of glucose-6-phosphate. Can this glucose-6-phosphate leave the cell? Is a good question. Because this phosphate group is highly polar, has a lot of ionized groups on it. So glucose-6-phosphate is trapped inside any cell. It can't leave. In order to leave the cell, that phosphate group, right, has to be removed from it. Right, so glucose-6-phosphate goes to glucose, and then glucose can be exported from the cell, and in particular, liver cells can do that. What do we call the name of an enzyme that can take a phosphate group off of something? It's a phosphatase. Right, so the name of this enzyme right here is what? Glucose-6-phosphatase. So jot that down right over here. Glucose-6-phosphatase will dephosphorylate glucose, and so then glucose can enter the blood. All right, here we have glucose in the blood. It gets absorbed by this liver cell. Liver cell traps it by phosphorylating it. What's the name of the enzyme that phosphorylates something? Kinase. And so this enzyme right here is called glucose kinase. So jot that down on this slide. Glucose kinase. What's the action of glucose kinase and glucose-6-phosphatase? They're antagonistic to each other. Okay? So that controls the amount of glucose that's inside this liver cell. So what can be the fate of glucose inside this liver cell? It can be used to make glycogen, or it can be used for glycolysis right here. So those are the two possible fates. So what do we call it when we take glucose and make glycogen out of it? This pathway right here. That's glycogenesis. What's the reverse of that process, going from glycogen to glucose? That is glycogenolysis, right? So that's 1 and 2 right here. 1 would be glycogenesis. Number 2 would be glycogenolysis, all right? And then going from glucose-6-phosphate right down to pyruvate, what do we call this pathway? That is glycolysis. Okay. The one thing that's not on this slide is that you can have an arrow going up, right, going the opposite direction of glycolysis. What would we call that? And that was your question. That would be the making of glucose from these precursors down over here. That would be gluconeogenesis. Gluconeogenesis. So next time we'll have to write those out on the board, define what they are, and relate it to this slide right here. Yeah. Glucose kinase.
Glucose kinase.
Everybody kind of knows what it does. Yeah. All right, so use what we talked about to figure out this Cori cycle a little bit for next time. All right, and then we get to talk about aerobic respiration. And there is a sign and sheet going around someplace. Oh, 5-hour energy. Yeah, there's no energy in it. Hi.
I'm having a hard time on the link to get to the simple questions, those difficult questions. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. Hold on, let me turn this microphone off.